Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 71 featuring Blake Sweeney from Method Studios. Blake is a good friend of mine. I have known him for a long time. As you will hear on the podcast, he has worked at a huge amount of places, probably some of the biggest places in the visual effects industry, such as Industrial Light and Magic, Weta, MPC, Digital Domain, and now at Method Studios, where he is the head of software. We had an absolutely amazing conversation, and I'm sure you will enjoy it as well. A couple of things I should tell you. The reason I'm a little late to this podcast is because I'm actually sitting in my hotel room in Zurich, and I am trying to figure out how to get it out on time, but I'm going to try to get it out to you guys as soon as possible. So here I am doing my introduction in Zurich. I just had an incredible time over at FMX this last week, where we were able to cover some incredible things, and I was able to participate in a really interesting forum on digital humans. And so it was just a really, really great time, and I really appreciate all the opportunities to be there and all of your feedback. And so it was really, really great. Hope to be there next year. Got a couple of Ask Vlados. I actually have several of them. I'm not going to read them all to you. I'm going to probably save some for next week. But keep those Ask Vlados questions coming. Put them up on Twitter and on Facebook. Just hashtag them with Ask Vlado. So here you go. I'm going to read a couple of them to you. The first one is from, I'm going to do this one. At M Stark TV, he asks, at CG Garage or at CG Labs, hashtag Ask Vlado. Can we expect to see GPU accelerated sims in Phoenix FD? Why is it known to be so difficult to program for the GPU? All right, so Vlado answers this with a couple of, since there's a couple of questions. GPU simulation for Phoenix FD is something we have eventually liked to explore, as GPU seems well suited for this sort of problem. However, right now, we are focusing on the next release of Phoenix FD later in the year, which is still CPU only. We had to reorganize the code in a major way in order to unify the plugins for 3ds Max and Maya and explore the new Flip Solver, and we had to improve the stability and usability of the product before we can think about GPU simulation. As for why it is difficult to program for the GPU, it is a little bit like rendering. If you want to use GPUs, you need to plan for it in advance. You can't just take existing CPU code and dump it into the GPU. Adding GPU support to an already large existing CPU code base is a real challenge. Well, that makes sense, of course. We already know how much of a challenge it is. We've had a lot of discussion on GPU programming when we did the Blago podcast a few podcasts back. So if you want to know more about it, go back to that podcast with BlagoVest. It's really cool. All right. The next one I'm going to read to you is from Jeff Muddle from Facebook. We all know Jeff, of course. Jeff is the founder of CG Architect, and he's been on the podcast a couple of times. But he wants to ask Vlado, how much can you bench press? And Vlado did respond to that. He said, about 90 kilograms, which I believe is about 200 pounds, which is pretty good, is the top that I've ever done, but I don't exercise to keep my, but I only exercise to keep myself in shape. I don't really push myself too hard. All right, guys, I really hope you appreciate this podcast with Blake. I've got several great ones that I recorded when I was at FMX, and those will be coming out at some point soon. And I've got a couple that I'm going to be doing while I'm here in Zurich, so it'll all be really great. There's lots of great episodes coming up. All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Alright. We're recording, but don't worry, I start it whenever it feels appropriate. You've heard these before.
Yeah. Welcome to the CG Garage. The Chaos Group
stuff. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, good. Good. How do you, when do you listen to these podcasts?
I've got a reasonable commute to work. So I live near Hollywood and I commute to Santa Monica.
Okay.
So yeah, I listen to podcasts and a lot of audiobooks.
I do too. You know, well, I listen to audiobooks. It's become my savior because of my dyslexia.
Ah.
I have a hard time physically reading books.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny is because I realize how hungry I am to actually read books. Mm-hmm. And it's just a real struggle for me for all my life. And then the drive has, you know, I've got a long drive. And so it's like, and suddenly when I started reading books online or doing audiobooks, it was like this perfect thing where I can actually just consume books.
Huh.
And it was at DD, actually. I was sitting there and I was reading two big series. I was reading the Millennium series for the whole, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo stuff.
Yep.
And the Game of Thrones series, which took me, I think between those two books, it took me almost a year and a half of driving. And I would be so excited when there was traffic because I could actually hear more of the books that were out there.
Yep.
Yeah. It was cool. I don't know. I like it.
Have you read the or listened to the Ed Catmull book, Creativity Inc., the Pixar one?
I did.
I loved that one so
much. It was
much.
Really good.
Yeah. I actually listened to it twice in a row. It finished and then I started it right over.
Yeah. It was a really good book, which I was a little bit torn because obviously the whole situation with Ed Catmull.
Well, yes.
Yeah. You know, it got a little bit harder to digest, but I had to divorce myself of that. And realize that the author is not necessarily the person in the same way that I feel that way about art, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Woody Allen is not necessarily the person I want to hang out with, but I love his movies, you know?
Yep.
And, you know, the same thing I feel about, what's his name?
Pete Rose.
No, not Pete Rose. He did the...
O.J. Simpson.
No. Another great filmmaker.
The statutory...
Yes, statutory rape guy. Yeah, what's his name? I'm blanking on it. He did The Apartment.
Yes.
All those. I mean, he's an incredible filmmaker. And yeah, name blank. Sorry, guys. You guys will have to fill me on Twitter and name that, name the filmmaker who's.
It'll come to us.
It'll come to us.
Minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like somewhere, he basically is not allowed in the United States anymore. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's. In my mind, still an amazing filmmaker,
yeah,
and I'm going to have to dismiss his personal life and and realize that the author is not the person, right?
Yep.
So same thing I'm going to do with Ed Catmull, not necessarily say that Ed Catmull's a bad person. I think that Ed Catmull's actually done some amazing things to our industry, and I love the history behind that book.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, to be honest, I will actually tell people, go out there, get Creativity Inc. as a book. It is a fantastic book. It is a really great book to learn about what we've done mm-hmm. in history, right?
Yeah, and they were on the brink of demise for so long when they were part of Lucasfilm and they were looking for someone to buy them and just the whole...
It sounds like gut-wrenching listening to it,
yep,
you know?
Absolutely.
And the relationship with Steve Jobs and how he tried to make things work and it was really, really good. And what's interesting is, you know, towards the end of the book, hearing how he transitioned the thought towards Disney.
Yep.
And if you, you know, remembering what he said about Disney and looking what Disney is doing now
mm-hmm.
and how they're thriving,
yep.
you know that Ed, you know, and obviously John Lasseter yep. as well, have a huge amount to do with the success that's going on there. And that's great.
Yeah, and to him, he seemed to really trumpet the culture and making sure that candor was the value, that the core value was just
right.
making sure. And he made a point to differentiate candor from honesty, where honesty is sort of, if you're not, quote, honest, then it seems like you're being dishonest, versus candor is just speaking your mind, being open, and just really being communicative and not clamming up.
Yeah, and I think... Also, just being yourself is cool and being open is cool. And his description of his first walking tour of Disney, where he walked to all the desks and all the desks were clean, is like, these are the most uncreative people ever. And he realized that after he did tour that they were given like he's going to walk through, so clean up your desks and make it all clean. And he's like, wait a minute, you just destroyed everything that was good about this place by making sure that everyone had clean desks. Like, clean desks is not necessarily a creative mind, you know? So, yeah, it was really cool. Really, really cool. All right, so let's go back in the Way Machine and before we even talk about your origins and talk about how you and I first worked together, which was Tron. And you were one of those guys that I knew. It was you and Parker and Lit. Like, I already knew. It was like, okay, these are the guys I need to get to get shit done, right? And you guys are really great. And I remember you were very honest with me about, oh, yeah, all right, okay, all right. Because I guess you were kind of new to V-Ray at that time, right?
Yes, brand new. I mean, we all were, though. You remember that was when V-Ray was 3D Studio Max, and not many people had actually tried it in Maya. And I
well,
remember,
yes and no.
Well, I mean, hold on. I remember the first... Like, first turntables were running, V-Ray stopped motion blurring after frame 999.
Yes.
Like no one had tested frame ranges greater than 1,000 in Maya. It was we were running into bugs like that when
yes,
we were testing
yes.
V-Ray.
Actually, I had when I first tried V-Ray for Maya, before even that, anything any frame that ended with 9 wouldn't render. I don't know why. But I mean, those are things, right? It was like, but of course, no one in commercials had ever rendered more than 1,000 frames, so that's why that. And so weird stuff like that would happen. But those bugs got squashed pretty quickly.
It
just needed to address them. But it was very interesting to sort of hear what was going on in that realm. And you were very like, okay, so Chris knows about V-Ray.
Yep.
And he knows how it's supposed to operate. So you bugged me for like, what is this supposed to do? You know, how is it supposed to work? And you were one of those guys I would approach and I was like, oh, okay. And you... And it's funny, I'm going to call you out on it. It's like you were one of those guys that would code at a breakneck pace. Like you type like so fast and you actually would, you know, you'd imagine like having a coding window up and you were like coding and like the multicolored code stuff that was going on in your window. And you're talking to me and coding at the same time. It's like, oh, yeah. And like you're typing. I was like, Jesus Christ. Oh, one of those guys that actually can split his brain to code and have a conversation at the same time.
I probably was screwing up a lot.
Probably. Yeah. But, you know, it looked cool to me. I was like, yeah, all right. So Blake's my guy. And that was a pretty interesting project. And I think, you know, we worked on a bunch of things. What was the main thing you were working on over on Tron at the time?
I started, what was it? I started when we were doing turntables and there was the whole Mental Ray versus V-Ray render test that were going on at the beginning.
Sure.
And I think that was actually before you started on it.
Mm-hmm.
I know I sort of got into it late, but John Litt and Steve Parker and Kami Leach and some other people were working on the tests of V-Ray versus Mental Ray. And then when I came in, it was like starting to run Light Jets and working on the LJ sequence.
Light Jets. That's right. You were working on Light Jets.
Yeah, with like Tim Nassauer and Greg Teagarden. And,
right.
Can't remember who else.
I remember there was actually a problem on the Light Jet sequence because we were traveling at ridiculous, you know, Mach 3 speeds on these Light Jets.
Yes.
And they were so far from the origins.
Yes.
That we were having precision issues specifically with subdivision surfaces.
Yeah. So V-Ray was single precision at the time. And Vlado actually came and visited and we gave him a few test scenes and he actually coded it there and tested and he got it working in double precision pretty quickly. But there was a point where like we were working with...
Okay. Now hold on. Did he actually make it work in double precision or did he just like...
He got us to work in double precision.
Okay.
So, and it didn't affect... polygons only affect sub-Ds because I guess the points are stored in world space for the meshes versus the actual transforms were stored double precision, I think. And then the polygonal geometry just offsets off of that.
Okay.
That was my, like, at least, rookie understanding of it. But
he got that working pretty quickly.
He did. Yeah, he did. So I remember at the beginning, we were actually writing all these scripts that would, like, recenter the entire world around the camera and offset everything. But... we didn't have to do that for very long.
He pretty much just did it in render.
Yeah. But it's always tough on a show where you have to do huge environments and you have to do characters.
Yep.
And like to choose the right unit of measure. So we worked in decimeters on that show because you want to be able to get a refraction in someone's eyeball, but at the same time, you need to be able to render a light jet that's like
traveling
500,000 units from right. the origin.
Yep. Yeah. I remember that. I mean, that's not an unusual problem.
No,
it's been around for. I remember dealing with that problem on Stealth.
Yeah.
When we were dealing with the jets, and they had all these cockpit shots, and they wanted to. Like, even though you have a camera locked off on a jet that's flying at ridiculous speeds, they still wanted the animation to work at ridiculous speeds.
Yep.
And so they'd have the camera locked off, and then the precision error was causing the pilot to jump around inside the cockpit where, like, nothing would actually match. And it's like, yeah, so that's not an unknown problem. You kind of have to recenter thing at the origins to get the precision right, right?
Yes. And I can remember starting shows where we had the units in meters and then having to do refraction in like, digit doubles and, like, eyeballs and stuff. And it was just impossible. Like, you couldn't do the eye geometry to work at that scale.
Yeah, but we talked about it before on the podcast. Tron was a big push for us in terms of figuring out if V-Ray would work for that process, and also obviously a big push for Chaos Group to make V-Ray work. And eventually, it worked really well.
Yeah, amazing.
With really good support from the developers, which minimized the need for us to do as much development on our own. Right.
Yep. And it was a totally different world too, because we stopped writing shaders at that point. Up to that point in Mental Ray and the other renderers, we were used to creating an entire shader writer department.
Right.
And it was great, but it was also a big drawback because it was great because you could create anything you wanted. And we would use, on some shows, we were using RenderMan, we were using Slim, and people could write SL boxes. Now, SL boxes are great in that you can make a shader do whatever you want within a scene, but it's harder to share that across shows. And then the next shows that have to pick it up, if the person who wrote a shader is gone, then you're looking at something that's potentially unsupported and not really be able to use what was there in the past. So we, on Tron and even subsequently on Real Steel, we deferred all the shader writing to Chaos Group. And anytime we wanted a change to the shaders. So it meant that the technical people could actually work on optimizing scenes, and just actually most people could focus on the look of shading rather than the nuances of how shaders would work. And bringing new people in didn't mean you had to learn this entirely foreign experience, or even from another show. Like,
right.
Yeah, there are many cases where on just different shows, you'd have a different shader lead, and they'd have shaders with completely different controls. And between Tron, and then I know you jumped on like Real Steel after that, and it was just exactly the same experience, exactly the same tools. And
well, that was interesting because, okay, I remember this was a big transition. Obviously, you know, we kind of like, it was an Eric Barber show, right? So he used to like the rebel guy at DD, and he was going to go out there and like do some different renders. And a lot of people that were in the traditional feature side were like, okay, well, Tron looks cool and all, but, you know, we don't know the pain of what that caused. So we're skeptical whether we should do this or go back to the old school methods that we've done. So Real Steel was kind of, again, debating that same question.
Yep.
Legitimately, everyone should. You know, you should always, you know, that's the thing about doing a movie is like you have the opportunity to pick the process you're going to do. And so that question came up was, will we use V-Ray on Real Steel, or will we go back to some of our older methods that we know are going to work, and will it look as good? Now, Real Steel obviously dealt with things that were very good for V-Ray at the time, ray tracing, etc., robots. And the question came up, was like, all right, what are we going to do? And you and I think Sven and Paul George set this question. It's like, we'll ask Chris, what does he think? And I was like, well, you know what I'm going to say. But like, what's the advantage of us doing it this way? And then it came, I remember the specific email you said, it's like, all right, we've looked at all the stuff, and my bet's on V-Ray. Like, my bet is we can make this happen on V-Ray, and let's take everything we've learned on Tron and apply it towards a new process and a new pipeline. And optimize it, because, you know, obviously we patched a bunch of stuff on Tron to make it work, but then, you know, like, now it's an opportunity to clean that up and make it better. And damn, that worked like gangbusters.
It was great. And the funny thing was, I mean, Real Steel was like started when Tron was still sort of in the heat of battle.
Absolutely. Yep.
But I do remember we had a lot of collaboration. Jim Rothrock actually rewrote the bitmap buffer in V-Ray.
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yep.
To utilize, what was it? Open. Was he using OpenImage.io?
Yes.
Yeah. So we could actually use then 8-bit MIPMAP textures, which at the time V-Ray didn't support.
Right.
So we actually, V-Ray got a boost even from that. So we were able to get our renders through with pretty low memory and
right.
They looked awesome. And at the beginning of Real Steel, I don't know if you remember this, we had a render off between the current RenderMan shaders we had there and V-Ray. And then we just put it in front of Nash, and Eric Nash chose, like, blind taste test. He chose V-Ray, which is, I mean, it's not the fairest test because it's just the way that the things happen to be put together.
Sure.
But the great thing about V-Ray was, I think we all liked the fact that it was image-based lighting, and we weren't baking out point clouds. We weren't baking out brick maps. It was all very, very much live, and you could make the changes just right there.
And there's several successes, I think, to Real Steel, and I want to call them out. Obviously, I think V-Ray has something to do with it. In fact, it was all real lighting. But our integration department was absolutely fantastic.
Yep.
Okay. So those guys went out there and they captured some of the best set data you can get around. And all the lighting was fantastic. So it was actually one of the easiest lighting jobs I ever did, because all you really had to do is, like, you want this robot to look correct in this scene, use the scene data and you're going to be like 99% there. And if you want something different, then make the correct choice. Because that was the difference, right? You're not going to just add a bunch of arbitrary lights just to make it look right. You have to just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. We had, I mean, it was also easy because we had, you know, more than 500 shots, but all the action scenes were located in very specific, repeatable environments. It was all within a boxing ring. Mm-hmm. So you set up a good light rig for a boxing ring, and then you have a light rig where you can just put, like, additional, like, soft boxes on each side or something, or kicker lights just to accentuate things. But they also built, like, do you remember that Legacy ended up building 3 robots, was it? They built Adam, they built...
Oh, the real robots.
They built Ambush, they built Noisy Boy.
Yeah.
And on set...
And they looked really good.
They looked great. And on set, they'd put those things on carts and, like, roll them all the way on the ring for each shot. So you'd have a perfect one-to-one match of exactly like, how
that's
it
how
look.
It's supposed to look.
And we had fantastic HDRs that we would use the whole Benjamin Buttons trick where you'd, like, extract all the lights, put them into...
on cards.
Yeah, on cards. And yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. In fact, I mean... Part of me is, you know, I've done that for years, and is taking these lights and putting them on cards and doing that. But what was really nice about, you know, obviously the Benjamin Buttons pipeline that was perfected, I think, a little bit on the Real Steel, or it continued to be perfected as different shows went on, was that it just became really easy for the lighters. Like, this is how it was lit. So you start with that and you'll be very, very close.
Yep.
And so you could just import the scene as it was done from set, and you're pretty much set. And like you said, you had a perfect reference.
Yeah.
And I remember there was some scenes with the director where he was making comments about the lighting on the robot. It's like, actually, that's a real robot, so we can't change the lighting on that. It's like, oh, I can't even tell.
Yeah.
So, in fact, one of the things I think it was secret, I think Eric Nash, who was also, did you hear the Eric Nash podcast on?
Yeah.
He even commented about the fact that we finaled a shot before they finished shooting. Do you remember that?
I remember them getting some shots on set and somebody saying, what if you do, don't show this to the director? And then he took a laptop and showed it to the director.
They showed it to the director and he finaled it, and they showed it to the crew on set while they were still shooting. And then, like, and everyone got excited, realizing, like, oh my God, this is going to be awesome. And so they got to see a post-production shot while they were still shooting. And that's got to be awesome for the guys on set. Like, you know, because otherwise, like, imagine a robot here and I don't even know what it's going to look like. And oh my God, it's going to look terrible. But then they see it and they're like, oh, it's going to look awesome. That just invigorates the shot. I think shrinking that line between post-production and production is going to be interesting as well. Yeah. Yeah. It was really, really, really cool. So I really like that. But let's go back a little bit. Where's your pasts, Blake?
The past.
Yeah. Because you were at ILM for a long time, right?
Yeah. That was my first job out of college. I started as a TA at ILM, which was doing tape IO.
Oh,
and so it was, yeah, right. It was the whole thing where you start on the day shift, which was 8 to 6, and then you go to the swing shift, which was 2 to midnight, and then you jump into the graveyard shift, which was 10 at night till 8 in the morning.
Really?
Yeah. So we were on the graveyard shift for a while, and then you do that in tape IO and eventually migrate over to the render support team, which was the other half of
how long the TA group. How long is your, how much time do you spend in tape IO before you can actually work on
tape IO? Was about 6 months, and then render support I think was a year, but I mean it's all just averages. But that's... it was amazing how many people came up through that. Like Jonathan Litt went, yeah, came through as a TA. I mean, God, you could just go through the list. Like a lot of visual effects supervisors have come through that route. I think a lot of, like, you know, Ken McGaw, mm-hmm, like Ryan Cook, trying to remember who else. When I started, Masioka from Heroes fame was sitting across from me. Wow. He was the developer for the TA group at the time.
But did, yeah, they still do that?
TAs?
Well, just like they don't tape IO anymore, right?
That's a good question. I mean, even at the time we had the robot, but it was still just writing the scripts and doing the, yeah, it's got to be more automated than it was back then.
Maybe, but I'm wondering, like, I mean, I guess that's the traditional path at ILM, right? Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, you got a job at ILM. Welcome to working in the vaults and doing yeah, medial tasks.
Yeah. Yeah, so most people would go from TA to ATD, then to full TD. And at ILM, everybody was a TD.
Right. It would
be like, you know, compositors or, lighters or anybody was just a TD.
Right.
The first screen credit I got was Galaxy Quest as a TA being render support, which was cherry. But dude, yes, I didn't work on the show at all.
It is cherry, but I remember, I think, who was the soup on that? Ben Snow? No.
Eric Brevig, right? The thing is,
no, from VFX support.
From render support, you don't end up working on the show. No,
I know that.
I think it was Eric Brevig, wasn't it?
We could look. Maybe it was Ben Snow. We'll have to look it up. But I remember an FX Guide podcast with him, and he talked about John Litt. I guess John Litt.
Sean was ATD in that show, I think.
ATD on Galaxy Quest.
Yeah.
And I guess that the big sequence that he was referring to was the rock battle.
The rock monster.
Greg
Knack. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you work on that? I mean, I guess you must have been.
No.
I was watching renders. You were watching renders.
I might have re-queued a frame or two that were really
okay,
came
all right.
Black.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I remember, like, that was not an, you know, okay, so... For people who may not realize it, like when, you know, big facilities have really good render support. So if you're a lighter and you do something and you send up stuff to the farm, if things mess up, then you got an ATD is going to take care of it for you. And in fact, when I remember at Sony and I was doing stuff on over there, and they were like, they'd call me up. It's like, there's a frame failed. I just want to see. I'm going to reset it with these settings. Is that okay with you? It's like, yeah, sure. Go ahead. You know, like whatever. And it's going to get done. Because, you know, some places, like if your frame fails, you come in the morning and it's like, oh my God, my frame's failed. And you got to fix it yourself. But yeah, like a render support guy will actually take care of that for you, right?
Yeah. And the best part about that to me is still that it's the farm team to get into the other job. So like, I mean, ILM is full of people who started out in that TA group.
Right.
Russell Earl, who's, you know, visual effects supervisor and awesome, came up through the same ranks. Like, you go from TA, you go from ATD, and then the people, as soon as they get to be a TD, they know more about the company than anybody else, and they've come up through the system. And
right.
But it does take an investment from the company to be willing to invest in good people at the starting position just to reap those benefits sort of later on.
So in that process takes several years, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you say yes in the sense that was painful? Or?
Well, no, it's sometimes can be a tough argument to make because most companies they look at render support in those entry-level positions as things that you can offshore. You can be like, well, can we get somebody somewhere else to do it, or can we hire a student to do it for minimum wage? But then you just don't necessarily end up with the talent you want to be, you know, progressing through the company.
Okay. All right. Well...
And I don't think you hire someone to do render support. You hire them to do the job you eventually want them to do for the potential, and then they just happen to be starting by doing render support.
That's all going to change. I mean, I think that a lot of that process and supporting an infrastructure, right? Because here's the thing, right?
It's interesting.
You're looking at supporting an infrastructure that's dealing with this. You're dealing with backups. You're dealing with render farms. You're dealing with everything like that. You just mentioned something very big because, like, you can just offshore that. You're not going to offshore that because I actually think I strongly believe that in a few years, it's all going to go to the cloud, and it's all going to go cloud rendering.
Yep.
And it's going to take place. And therefore that the cost, everyone's like, oh, the cost of the cloud is really high. Not really, because all you're paying for all the people and the machines and the air conditioning and everything else to do that.
Yep.
And if you put that on a cloud and you don't have to worry about backups and you don't have to worry about all those failures of frames that are randomly happening or whatever else,
yep,
that's going to go away. So offshore is not necessarily what's going to happen. What's going to happen, it's going to go cloud, and therefore the cost is going to go away. And in fact, if you don't go to the cloud, you're going to not be competitive anymore.
Yep. Yeah. Especially if you work in really a cyclical company. Like if you have a huge baseline, it's not as important. But if you work with a company and you need 100 nodes for this month, but then you need 1,000 nodes for the next month,
yep,
trying to do the burst just kills the system seams. And
yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that Kevin Bailey said on his podcast is like the great thing about the cloud is that it scales up really well. It also scales down really well.
Yeah.
So you don't actually pay for it when you're not using it.
Yeah.
So
there were a lot of concerns for a while about the security, like that a lot of clients just wouldn't allow things to necessarily run.
Well,
I
think that's ignorance, to be honest. No, I do. I think because, well, I'll tell you this. You say the cloud, people assume that it's out on YouTube, right?
No. I mean, these are companies that just want to run like really intense audits. But it sounds like most of those companies have been working with,
yes,
with Google.
Exactly. And like so here's the argument that I'm going to say as a cloud advocate, I'm going to put that hat on for a while, and I'm balancing it because I believe that there's several sides to the story. But let's say I'm a cloud advocate right now. If I'm going to go out there and I'm going to push for cloud, right, and I'm going to say, let's say I'm Google or Amazon or any one, mm-hmm, of those companies out there, and I'm going to say, I'm going to go to the FCC
MPA.
MPA, thank you. And I'm going to say, I'd like to be certified for the cloud. Then if I get, let's just use Google as an example, saying I'm Google certified for the cloud, and they're like, great. And they look through the process of what it takes to render on the cloud using whatever system they have, let's say Zinc or whatever. And I can assure them that all those checks and balances are done so that everything's encrypted on the way out.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that's on the cloud is blocked off completely, which is an important part of the things that they have to understand. And it's a technological thing. It's like blocked off somewhere on the cloud is a hard thing to grasp, right? Like, mm-hmm, they almost like they're used to there's a key in the machine room and therefore no one can go in there and get the stuff. But if it's going somewhere in Ohio, they're a little freaked out. So we have to assure them that there's a virtual key somewhere that's locking everything down that they can't see.
Hmm.
But once they get that understanding, okay, oh, that's how it works, then they can certify that system, cloud, mm-hmm, system, whether it's Amazon or Google or whatever. And so therefore, if you're a company and you say, we want to do this, it's like, are you MPA certified? They don't actually have to come to your facility. It's like, we're using system X, which is already certified. Therefore, now I don't have to worry about it anymore.
The thing is, most of those companies now want to do an additional audit because they want to make sure that your connection between your company and that cloud platform is secure.
So sure. So that's one thing they have to certify.
Yes,
yep. As opposed to, I mean, I've seen,
yes,
I got to say, I mean, I have seen the most ridiculous MPAA certification system. I've visited a lot of studios, right? Some of them are literally a clipboard attached to a room saying, here is a sign in and sign out, and that is enough to certify them. That's insane to me. It's like, that's what we had to do to certify this facility. And that doesn't even make any sense. It's like, you know, we walked into that facility. I didn't sign a freaking facility thing. You know, like it doesn't even make any sense. It's like a weird political thing. It's like, it's like, that's not secure. Like, I walked in there and said, oh, look at all these blinking lights, blah, blah, blah. And here's our MPA certification. They show me the clipboard, which I didn't sign, but I was there anyway. So the MPA certification in terms of local facilities is BS. I'm sorry, but
I don't know.
I mean, sorry, but it is some in some cases. I mean, it's and by the way, that was one facility, and another facility was completely different. So no matter what you go, it's like there's no real standards. I don't think the MPA certification is really standard. On top of that, MPA certification is one level security, and then you got studio certification. Yes. So if you're working on, let's just say, a Marvel show.
I've heard they have a lot of security.
Yes, Marvel shows have a completely different level of certification, and that is called on different things. And that one is way more serious than the regular MPA certification.
Yes.
And so, you know, and then things, I don't know. I just still have a problem with the fact that they cut off internet to random users because they don't, you know, whatever. I think there's a lot of certifications that are a little bit out of control. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, people need to just trust the certifications or the security systems that have been put in place for years in other industries, right? The military uses the military uses the cloud. Mm-hmm. Military uses Amazon, right?
Yep.
If the military uses Amazon, I think we can generally trust Amazon as a cloud system.
Yep.
Anyway, side note, but I think it's an interesting conversation, and we'll get to, it probably leads to what your current job is. So your time at ILM, and you worked on a bunch of stuff over there.
Yeah. So After the TA thing, I was ATD on Pearl Harbor. So that was the first show I actually put hands on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Ben Snow was on that one.
Okay.
And Mike Bauer. And then, but Eric Bravig was the VFX soup on that.
Okay. So what were you doing on Pearl Harbor?
I was rendering really small background boats and doing general technical support. So
were you responsible for ambient occlusion?
Oh, I was, we worked on, oh, you love ambient occlusion. That's right. I see the look on your face. So it's funny because yes. So who was on that? Ken McGaw, Hayden Landis and Hilmar Koch. And so Hayden, they wanted to bake out all the ambient occlusion for the boats because when the boats didn't have moving parts, you could just bake.
Or the planes too and stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yep. So we did a lot of ambient occlusion baking. So I did usher some of that stuff through.
Okay. So I remember the first time I heard of ambient occlusion, I guess, was at SIGGRAPH in San Antonio. And it was I was still an architect at the time, and I had been working in global illumination for years. And this guy at ILM was like telling me, he's like, oh, I love global illumination and architecture. And so I was like, yeah, we came up with this really interesting, crazy hack to try to get it done. It's called ambient occlusion. And it's just basically a way to just sort of fake ambient light. And he was telling me this. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting and kind of smart. But it's like, that's not global illumination. And he goes, no, it's not. Absolutely not. It's a complete stupid hack to get it working.
Yep.
But that became like the Bible for a long time. I think that was a huge deal, right?
It looked pretty good and it was fast. And if you implemented the entire thing, it would also have the bent normal. So when you did the ambient lookup, it would take the actual bent normal for where most of the rays were actually able to come in.
Right.
But back at that time, we were actually rendering out the AO passes using mental ray. And then,
oh, really?
And a lot of times it would be a camera render. Like if you had something that was deforming, like the Hulk, then you'd render out the ambient occlusion and reflection occlusion from the camera perspective in mental ray, and then that would be NDC projected back into the RenderMan shader.
Really? Yeah. Because I guess the RenderMan ray tracer was pretty slow at that time.
I don't even know if it existed. I mean, back then in 2001, I don't even think it existed.
It didn't even exist. Yeah. Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I remember on Ghost Rider, we were doing something similar to do obviously all the bikes and all that stuff. And I was like the last shot I had to deal with was like this big epic shot, the first transformation shot of the bike that he did where he puts his hands on the tank and it transforms. So it was like this long, like 1,000-frame shot of the transformation. And of course, they wanted to make it look awesome, right? And so we did the traditional way we've been doing everything, where we do like a reflection occlusion, everything else. And it just didn't look shiny enough because reflection occlusion doesn't actually have true reflection. And so they're like saying, and RenderMan was not necessarily the greatest ray tracer at the time.
Right.
And they told me, like, okay, do like 2 bounces of light, and it was going to take a week and a half to render, the whole shot.
Oh my gosh.
And they said, all right. And it was my last shot to do anyway. And I had plenty of time. And it's like, all right, just put it on the farm and then spend the next week and a half figuring out if you can make it faster. And so that's what I did. And then they're like, you know, trying to put it in mental ray, and then it didn't look right. And it looked way better because it was truly ray traced, but it like, but then it like didn't have the same look and they couldn't do that. And then like finally at the end, I basically just, after about 3 or 4 days of trying different things, I just, you know, gave up and I said, all right, that's all right, you know. And I went to the movie theaters for a few days and let it render. But yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. Ray tracing was kind of, that was starting to become more important in the feature film world at that time.
Yeah, and I do remember with the RenderMan releases, every single release, they say ray tracing is twice as fast. Like every single release.
Every release,
in the release notes, ray tracing is twice as fast.
Yeah, but I think now, like in RenderMan 19 and 20, it's actually it's pretty much like on par with all the other renderers, right? Yeah. And I haven't tried it in a long time. I'm actually, I'd be curious to try RenderMan again. I know Philip LaPrince has been telling me about some interesting things. Yeah. Are you on 3D Pro? You are.
I am on 3D Pro.
But you don't follow it that much.
I'm a few messages behind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of going a little crazy right now. But yeah, it's interesting to see where rendering is going these days. Obviously, most of the big renderers are all pretty hardcore ray tracers now, right?
Yeah, and they all seem to be doing the denoising trick now too.
Some of them are. We did it just because Vlado said, I guess I'm just going to join the bandwagon. I am, I guess I'm going to say, theoretically opposed to denoising.
Interesting.
And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you a story specifically on Tron. There was some guy who was on Tron and he was lighting stuff and he was not necessarily a great lighter. but he was like bragging about how fast his renders were. And so he was rendering them at really low quality and denoising them in Nuke, which, by the way, is different denoising than what I'm talking about. But he was denoising them in Nuke, and then everyone was looking at the renders, and it was like the textures look really soft, and they were kept up-resing the textures and like putting all this pressure on the texture team, and then eventually found out that what he was doing. When we found out what he was doing, it happened on the last day, and I was the compositor told me about it. He said, and the compositor had a conniption because he was like struggling to finish like one of the last shots in a movie. And we were having our celebration party. Remember, like they had the food trucks out there and we're having drinks and everyone was celebrating. And so Nikos was bringing me hot dogs and beer and asking me to please finish the shot correctly. And I was like struggling to like actually do it correctly. And I was like, never denoise. And so I've been hurt by knee denoising. But I know that denoising now is a lot smarter, right?
Yeah, much smarter. I don't actually understand completely how it works, but if it uses velocity pass, it only denoises the right channels. And
well, it uses a whole bunch of the passes, right? So it knows where not to remove noise. Mm-hmm. It'll use the diffuse pass to know where the textures are supposed to look like, because the textures that are in the diffuse pass don't have any render noise. So it only denoises basically the elements that need to be denoised, like the lighting pass and the reflection pass, and then doesn't denoise the other and puts them back together again, which is, it's interesting. I mean, it works well. And if you need to get something done in half the time or less, you can do a pretty good job with that denoiser. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, right? Rendering is rendering, just like photography, you know. You want it faster, like, you know, a faster shutter, you're going to get noise, right?
Yep.
So that's cool. So, okay, so how was stuff at ILM after that?
So ILM, it was a lot of fun. I just, at one point, I kind of wanted to try. I felt like I was never going to leave if I didn't just leave at that point. So I decided to go to Weta for Lord of the Rings thing. So I went for Return of the King in 2003, and I got there I got there August 2nd, and I got the first Sunday off. And then, but that first week I was there, they said, you know, Weta is now open 7 days a week. So from that point,
so until, you literally arrived in New Zealand and you're working 7 days a week. Right,
yeah,
off the bat.
And I mean, we didn't always have to work all day on Sunday, but it was. It was a total blast. And one of the reasons I went there was because I knew like Sam Cow was there, and I sort of followed him. But it was fun. And then it was one of those things where the deadline was October 25th. We couldn't push past October 25th. And then a couple of days before that, they pushed it to November 17th. And you've probably been there where you're just burning and you're targeting that one deadline. And since they move it, it's just all the energy sort of goes out.
Yeah, you're like, I'm going to work till here and then I'm done. And it's like, no, you're going to add another 3 weeks to that.
Yeah. Yep.
So how long were you on God,
that was like 3 months or something. It was the beginning of August till mid-November.
Oh, so that's a hard push.
Yeah, it was a blast. I mean, it was one of the fun things about Weta. Well, I mean, gosh, there were a lot of fun things about Weta. But at the time, it felt like so many people came from just different places that not a lot of people had an established routine, an established social group. So everybody just sort of hung out. And there were a lot of...
Because everyone was just thrown into the mix at that point, right?
Yeah, and it also felt like the HR in New Zealand wasn't as stringent as it is in other places. So there would be these... God, I don't even know whether to talk about this. Like, there'd be... What was it? There was some sort of free mail alias, and it was like every Friday was Porn Friday, and people would send out...
Wait, they had that at Escape, too.
They had it at ESC, too.
Yeah.
So probably somebody from ESC took it to Weta.
Yeah, but, and basically you'd like email each other random disgusting porn.
Right. So at some point, people realized there were too many people spending time like surfing the internet for pornography. So somebody created a random porn generator, you know, where there'd be this like, you could push a button on this webpage and it would just send an automatically like found image of pornography to the entire company.
So someone created a script to more efficiently search for porn.
Exactly, for you. And then, but then you'd have the problem where people were going in there and pushing the button like 20 times in a row. So they ended up putting like a timer in so you could only push it once every few minutes. It was like the lengths they went to for that were pretty.
Yeah. It's funny when you have people that are really smart and can write a bunch of scripts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I remember when at DD, there was a time when I was on day, there was a guy, I guess, who quit. I forgot his name. I think his name was, I don't remember his name. Anyway, there was an icon, you know, because then you work in Nuke and you're on a show, people make shelves for the show or for the company. Yeah. And there's a bunch of icons up there for buttons you can push to do something for the show or for the facility or whatever you're doing. And there was this picture of this guy and you'd push it and nothing would happen. But what actually did happen, or nothing seemed to happen, but what actually did happen is it would send him an email because he was at Sony. So he'd get these random emails from people that were at TD.
Just testing
Like click, click, click. You'd like test it, like push this button and you'd get emails. Yeah. It was kind of funny. Like, you know, you can just make these random tools that are out there.
Yeah, it's something that predated me by a little bit at Weta was when I got there, there was this whole cafe press site with Napoleon Wang gear. It was like, who's Napoleon Wang? And I guess there was, like, I don't know the whole story, but somebody ended up writing an AI bot. I think it might have been Martin Preston or something that would automatically respond to certain forum posts. And it would just insult people. That was this whole thing. It would like insult people, but they like, I guess when they turned it on, it wasn't, the bugs weren't all worked out, so it ended up, it's kind of like the Microsoft thing that's happening now, right? Where the bots responding, but it ended up responding just like to every message like 100 times or something with all these insults, like just calling everybody diaper head. So they found out about it and ended up shutting it down. But then they created this cafe press thing and started saying like free Napoleon, like bring Napoleon back.
Right,
it wasn't playing.
Yeah, I kind of like those random tools. I mean, it was. Remember at DD when they had, I guess it was called Storm, but it was Voxel Bitch at the time, right? And it would send up these messages. You'd hit render, and it's like, remember, today is Tuesday. It's happy hour starts at 5 o'clock at the firehouse. It's like you'd get these messages that were so directly towards what your interests were. I mean, it'd be really hilarious if like a normal company would like have these messages that would tell you things that are like, oh yeah, by the way, since you know it's happy hour right now, you should probably get going. It was pretty hilarious. All right, so Weta, what happened?
I spent, you know, a month touring around New Zealand, and after that I decided to go to London. And I went. I worked at MPC.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So it was funny. I actually flew out there on New Year's Eve,
okay.
flying to London. So the flight left at something like 10 o'clock
so
at night.
So you flew from
December 31st. I came back to my family in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
And ended up flying.
That's where you're from originally, huh?
Yeah, Northern California. Yep.
Okay.
But it was the emptiest flight I've seen in my entire life. So I had an entire row to just sort of spread out because it was, you know, we were on the plane over New Year's.
Right.
But yeah, and I worked there as a crowd simulation guy on Troy for a little bit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then I was on that for maybe a month or two, and then I got pulled to work
on... Was that all Massive?
No, they MPC had their own crowd system
right.
called
their
Mass.
Own yeah, okay.
And I don't remember everybody who was working on it, but yeah, it was good. It was
okay.
pretty good.
Yeah. So you did Troy for a while at MPC.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that?
I got pulled to work on Alien versus Predator. So like at one point I sort of wanted to slow burn in London and just sort of hang out and get to know the area. But yeah, the show needed help and they came and they asked me if I wanted to be on it as a lighting lead. And I said, no.
Okay.
And then 2 days later they came back and they said, well, we don't have anybody else. So you're going to be the lighting lead in Alien versus Predator. So
yeah.
That was, yeah, jumping on there. And there was some crowd stuff. So that was actually sort of fun doing like crowd aliens and then working with the team. And it was actually,
right.
it was a great group of people. Like I loved the show, but I ended up working a lot during my time in London.
Right.
And then at the end, again, I just took a month off and bought the rail pass and traveled around.
Okay. You just went around Europe and stuff?
Yeah. Started in, like this isn't interesting.
Sure it is.
Started in Spain and went east out to, where did we go? We went to Budapest, and
nice.
Then it was actually the year of the Olympics in Greece. So I was
I
was traveling with a friend, Drew Hess. And we ended up flying to Greece for the Olympics, and then after that, we continued up through Sweden.
Oh, nice!
And then, yeah, and then flew back to London and flew home.
Yeah, you know it's interesting. I lived in Europe for a long time. As you know, my mother's Hungarian.
Cairo, right?
I was born in Cairo, and I lived there till I was 6, and I lived in Athens from the age of 6 till 17.
Huh.
And I traveled a lot in Europe, obviously. One area of Europe I have never been to is actually Scandinavia, which is part of my goal. One of the nice things about the company I work with is that we have customers all over the world, and so there's opportunities. So I am looking forward to some kind of a Scandinavian trip at some point. We have some really interesting clients in Sweden.
You work with Port Lincoln Pirates, right?
Yeah, ILP.
Aren't they?
They're in Sweden.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's a couple other great guys in Sweden as well. But ILP is great. And they've actually been on the podcast.
Yeah.
Really, really nice guys. They're all from the industry and they sort of formed their own little company. Great work that they do over there.
Yeah.
And there's some guys over in Norway that I've also been very interested in talking to. A lot of... another huge customer we have in Sweden is a small company called IKEA. Yeah. And they're fantastic. And Martin and those guys are really, really cool guys. But also in Norway, there's some fabulous ArcVis companies up there. There's a company called Mir that's incredible. They do just some of the most stunning ArcVis in the world. I mean, people seek them as like the leading ArcVis company out there, really, really cool guy. And then there's, some really just fascinating people up in Scandinavia. So that's my goal. Maybe sometime I'll go up there. I'll have to make sure I do it in the summertime though. So yeah, I'm very, very interested in going up to Scandinavia. But so yeah, so you got to travel a little bit in Europe.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
And then after that, I came back to work at ILM again on War of the Worlds. And so that was 2005.
Oh, my God. Okay. So tell me about War of the Worlds. That must have been crazy because that timeline was short.
It was, something like 6 months. So it started, November of 2014 or something and delivered maybe May of 2015.
Yeah.
Or 2004 to 2005.
Right. Because I was actually angry at that show because they basically like proved to people that you can do something in 6 months and at that level and just like you're going to destroy everything. Everyone's going to expect that level of delivery.
Yeah. I don't remember how big the show was, but they actually did have two VFX soups on that. So they broke it down into smaller shows to really get
Pablo
through.
Was one of them.
Yeah, Pablo and Dennis Muren.
Oh, Muren as well.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. That makes sense because it was a Spielberg film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was a really good job.
Yeah.
Really good. I remember obviously the big shot around the car.
Yeah. That was amazing.
That was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Incredible work. So what were you doing on that show?
What was it? So at I did some smoke sims and like a lot of hero lighting on some of the giant robots. I don't even remember what they were called. But you know, the guys with the long legs.
Yeah.
And some digidoubles and some water. Like some water sims. But at the time, I mean, when I say water sims, it was
particles. So you were doing a lot of fluid stuff on top of lighting, right?
But it wasn't fluids. Like I was doing the cheap stuff. So I was rendering like smoke simulations using sprites because they actually, the funny thing was at Weta, they used a ton of sprites on the Lord of the Rings movies. So for a lot of the smoke,
it was all just practical elements they would sprite in there?
That was the shots that I saw were a lot of that. And the Balrog was done with sprites. Mm-hmm. Like at the beginning, the Eye of Sauron, all the flames around the eyes were done with just sprites. It was flame elements on cards that, because I ended up working on a couple of Eye of Sauron shots and it was all just eye geometry and using like Maya sprites and like the paint
effect stuff.
No, it was like the per particle rules for like the goal U and the goal V and just like writing those expressions and then some expressions on top of that. But I ended up just sort of reusing a lot of the same techniques that we used on Return of the King back on War of the Worlds.
Hmm.
But yeah, and it was amazing like how the smoke you could render actually did look pretty good.
Right.
For what it was.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting just to think about that. I mean, you couldn't get away with that as much in stereo, right? Because you're just basically pasting a bunch of cards in there, right?
Yeah, no. Yeah, that would be tough. And it was all the little tricks. Like you'd have, I mean, the sprite would always be just pointing straight at camera. But then for the shadows, you'd actually have the sprite. Like, because at the time we were using deep shadows in RenderMan. So you'd have the sprite aim at the light for the shadow passes so that the shadows would still have the smoke texture in them.
Oh.
Because if you just try to do it all on ray tracer with cards, then you'll end up with flat shadows.
With like these weird like flat shadows.
Yes. Yeah. So you'd like run noise and sort of offset, like displace some of the texture like towards or away from the light. So you'd get that additional texture in there. It ended up looking pretty good.
So you had
good.
Two different passes, a shadow pass and a light pass,
yeah,
right?
And I mean, that was the way it always was, right?
Yeah,
back in the day,
you'd
render the depth map shadows and so it worked pretty well for what it was.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, interesting.
But it took a lot of care and just to make the simulation right. And the nice thing was you could actually view it in the Maya hardware too. So when you were simulating, you'd get to sort of see what it looked like, the distribution. But it fell apart if you tried to put too many particles in. It was really just like placing a toupee. It has to be exactly perfect.
Like placing a toupee. I like that. All right, so here we are. So now you've gone to ILM, you've gone to Weta, you've gone to MPC, and back to ILM.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So where are you now from there?
After that, a buddy and I, Sam Cow and I, we decided to start a company.
Yeah.
So we moved to LA and we started a company just
Why
from,
did you
from
move to LA?
Because we figured that would be a better place than Northern California to get industry contacts.
Okay.
And to tie in with people. And it turns out starting a company is actually pretty hard.
Yes.
That, I mean, it wasn't like...
Not anymore. Like, you just go into Silicon Valley. People start up companies all the time.
The funny thing is like, yeah, creating an LLC isn't the hard part, but it's like trying to do everything and not being willing to... I think you really have to be willing to put yourself out there and go into debt, like really spend money to get a good start. So what we did was we moved to LA and we both put down really a pittance, like not much money. And we were sort of like, okay, that's it. Now whatever we make off of that, we can reinvest back into the company. But we bought a couple computers and we ended up stress testing them by playing World of Warcraft for 3 months, which
really?
Was sort of like...
So you didn't actually do anything, you just played video games.
I think, yeah, we ended up not doing much for those first few months, which was great because I mean, we were just getting to know LA anyways. But after that, we ended up buying some software licenses and just trying to find work. So
What was the goal of the company when you tried to start a visual effects company?
We were starting a visual effects company. So we started out doing a lot of just sort of subcontract work. Who do we work with? We worked with Prolog. So we did it's funny. I've actually seen a lot of the Prolog guys since. But we ended up doing some Superman Returns credits just from upstairs.
Yep.
We only had like a couple RenderMan licenses and we had a couple Shake licenses.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up rendering the opening sequence for Superman Returns where you're flying through space. Like,
okay.
So we did some elements for that. We worked with them on a couple other movies. Across the Universe was one, the Julie Taymor Beatles movie.
So were they in Venice at the time?
They were not. They were up in Malibu. It was a great,
oh really?
Yeah, it was a beautiful place, or it was near Malibu. It was like right on the coast, sort of. Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. But the thing was, we'd get this work that would start, you know, on a Thursday and end the following Tuesday, and it wasn't. We should have probably hired a producer, because it just landing the work and doing the work at the same time for us was
a little difficult. Produce and do it at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and neither of us were really the schmoozers who were going around and taking meetings. But it was fun. We learned a lot, and ended up doing learning how to do a lot of roto and doing a lot of green screen extractions and compositing. So it was a good, starting a company is a good way to learn the visual effects pipeline from start to finish.
Yeah.
But then we in 2007 we decided to take an on-site contract gig at ILM to work on Pirates 3.
Okay.
So we were there for a little while, and then after that we continued to contract at DD, and that was my first time at DD, and that was for Speed Racer.
Oh. So you were still under the old company?
Yes.
But the two of you were like, okay, so you're like two guns for hire under the company, yep. But basically you're employees of Digital Domain?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And ILM, I guess, at the same, for when you were up there on yep. Pirates, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, Speed Racer was great. And at the same time, it was very difficult. The crew on Speed Racer is just amazing. It's funny how many of those people we still see yeah. and work with now.
Yeah. But it was a tough show.
It was a really tough show. And yeah. That was where DD tried to go full on into Mental Ray, and they wrote all their own shaders for that. But Mental Ray really struggled with the motion blur. I don't know if it was the way it was set up, but we ended up doing all the motion blur as a post-process.
Yeah, which is... painful for a show that has probably a massive amount of motion blur, right?
Yes, a lot of motion blur. And the main point of using one of the best selling points of Mental Ray was you got the beautiful reflections and you could actually motion blur and get nice reflections. So they did, it was a
but they ended up getting smeared if you do it in
yes.
the post.
So it was actually they did the motion blur using a depth pass and a velocity pass, and it ended up making the comps take a pretty long time too to run. Right. But I mean, I thought the work that DD did actually looked pretty good on the show, but it was, there was a lot of pain to get that work done.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard about that show. All right. So then you ended up staying at DD for a while, I guess.
Yeah. I stayed
Did you get on Buttons?
No, I was on G.I. Joe, and then I jumped onto, I guess it was G.I. Joe when Buttons was running.
I guess so.
Right? Yeah.
So the whole Paris sequence?
Yep. Yeah, the Paris stuff. It was actually a lot of the car and the missiles coming out of a car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the guys jumping over the cars and all that stuff. Yeah.
And the plane and Digit Devils. It was a cool show.
Yeah. And what ended up getting you onto Tron? Was there a show between those two?
Tron? I don't think so. I think I just rolled straight onto Tron at the end of that. I feel like maybe my memory is just leaving me.
Okay. But yeah, well, that's fine.
I think it was straight on to Tron after that. And that was my first show then. There were multiple pipelines running at DD at the time. There was the Renderman pipeline, which was the G.I. Joe Foundation. And then the Mental Ray run, which I guess was, it morphed a little bit from Speed Racer to Tron.
But yeah, I guess it was also on Benjamin Buttons too.
Yes, that's right.
And then you had the V-Ray pipeline that was coming out of commercials at the same time.
Oh, interesting. What was
that? Commercials was doing a lot of V-Ray stuff.
But in Max, right? Okay.
Yep, in Max. So that's three different renderers out there, which was, you know, challenging, and you had to pick them.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point we had four renderers.
well, geez, what do you mean when we added Arnold?
Yeah, we added Arnold to it, which was also, is interesting. And to be honest, it's like, it's fine, you know, just pick one and just go with it and just stop.
Yeah.
Stop going around. So after Real Steel, was that your last show at DD?
What happened after that? No, I wanted to, at that point, it just felt like DD, what were the shows there? So Jack was running, but Jack was a...
Were you on Jack?
I ended up being on Jack for a bit. So Jack the Giant Slayer, but it was an interesting show because there were only a couple people, there were a handful of people in Los Angeles on it. So I was sitting right by Masuo and we were both working on it, but it was a lot of Katana testing and support and some Arnold testing.
Yep.
And then there was a whole nother team in San Francisco, and there was a whole nother team in Vancouver.
Right. Right.
So I ended up getting pulled off of that and put onto the Paradise Lost test.
Oh, yes, of course. With which never got made.
Yeah, never got made.
But yeah, it was a big show, and a lot of the people that were on Paradise Lost, that's right, ended up going towards Maleficent.
Ah, okay.
And I don't know if you actually made it to the Maleficent side of things.
No, I ended up leaving when I was on Paradise Lost to go to Method, because it felt I thought we were going to be able to recapture the. I felt like Real Steel was a perfect show, mm-hmm. and a lot it was very good. The client was awesome, and the quality of the set capture was great.
Sure,
and the crew was fantastic, and I loved working with everybody.
Yep,
and we kept trying to find that next show, and I kept going to the producer Dan Brimer and seeing if we could find it, and it just nothing was really coming up at that point, and mm-hmm. And that was before the bankruptcy, but it was right when DD went public, and it just. I don't know if it just something felt unsavory subconsciously.
You left, I guess, around the bankruptcy time. It must have been.
It was a while before the bankruptcy, I guess. But
you're
after,
right. You're right. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maleficent. Oh my God. So a lot of the stuff here's the thing, right? So Paradise Lost never actually happened, but a huge amount of work was done on Paradise Lost, which translated into why we ended up actually getting Maleficent because. I think it was Disney as well. I'm not sure. But they at least trusted us like, oh, we know the kind of work that you guys have done on this. We can just translate that information back to this Maleficent project, which in the end ended up looking really good.
It looked great. I can't believe the hair. The hair looked freaking amazing.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of great work done at Digital Domain, but I actually want to make sure that, people know how much Chaos Group actually did to make that work because we rewrote a lot of the hair and skin shaders based on what was being done on that show. So we had developers from Chaos Group at Digital Domain working and taking scene files from Maleficent and optimizing them and making them faster and better.
Funny. Huh.
So that's how it ended up being. So a lot of V-Ray 3 in terms of the benefits that people are getting from hair and skin on V-Ray 3 are based off of the things that was learned on Maleficent.
Nice.
Yeah, it was good. It was really good. Anyway, so you went to Method, which is a big move for you, right? Yeah. So what was your role at Method when you started there?
I was a CG supervisor on Cloud Atlas. And it was, I knew a couple people from there. And it seemed like a good opportunity. So I've been at Method since.
I like Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, Cloud Atlas was a really cool movie to work on. And it felt like we were very close.
Was Dan Glass the supervisor on it?
Dan Glass was the client side supervisor, and Matt DeSero was the supervisor at Method.
Okay, because Dan Glass is also at Method though.
He is at Method. He was sort of loaned. I mean, he was working directly with the Wachowskis on that one.
Okay. He's obviously had a relationship with the Wachowskis for a while.
Yeah.
He's a super nice guy.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah,
Met him a couple times, and, I think Dan Glass is super nice.
Yeah.
Obviously, I could just tell that he's sharp as a tack.
Incredibly sharp.
And just really knows his stuff and seems a very reasonable person, too, which is also nice and refreshing.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've worked with Matt DeSero.
I don't know him, no.
He's a great, he just has a fantastic eye. Great VFX soup. So it was fun to work on Atlas. That was the first experience I had with him. And
I guess, was Jupiter Ascending part the next, was that?
Jupiter Ascending was next. That came a while after.
So right, but it's similar crew, I'm assuming?
Who worked on Jupiter? I think most of that work from Method. There was a lot of it that was done in London.
Okay.
And then some of it was done in Los Angeles. But yeah, okay. I think, no, that's right. Matt was on that. But I think it was after I moved over to the software team.
Okay. All right. So you were supervising a couple of shows at Method and then you moved to the software team. So explain to me what that is.
so it was, about May of 2014. I was interested in doing more development.
You want to actually get your hands dirty in,
yeah,
in
because
code.
It was one of those things where you could do it on shows, but then you'd always get pulled away from it. You can never really you couldn't finish.
You have to
a
just hack things together.
Showing. Yeah, you'd hack them together for shows, and it yep. also felt like we wanted the development team to have a closer tie into production.
Okay.
So the hope was that, like my hope, and I think the hope of the people who allowed me to make the transition was that I would bring more of a production perspective and focus to the pipeline team. So that taking that in and just making sure the things we were working on as the team were directly benefiting production and that we're aligned with production priorities versus being more of a sequestered, you know, just development group.
Okay. So would it be safe to say that, you know, I did a podcast with Doug Robel.
He's a brilliant guy.
He is a brilliant guy. Would you say that you have similar responsibilities that a Doug Robel has?
Doug is, he's more software side. Like, so DD.
But you are a software.
Well, but so DD is actually run differently though. So they're, okay. they're like different studios are set up in different ways where some studios are set up where the pipeline teams live directly on the shows. So
yes.
at DD, each show had a pipeline supervisor and each show had their own pipeline teams.
Which is basically making tools or mostly quick tools, like you need to make a tool in like a day or two.
Yes and no, because I don't know if you like most of the tools that we used in production were written. The texture published was written by Laura Lee on Real Steel.
Yeah, and that continued to be rolled over on other shows.
Yes, but a lot of times that would result in completely different pipelines and shows going in totally different directions. Mm-hmm. Without, and there was a central entity at DD to do software development that mm-hmm. was Doug's group, but that. I feel like that wasn't always combined with the pipeline team, which was doing the more sort of day-to-day show development. So the central team, I think they did turn out what was the dailies tool? Like
DMX?
Yeah, DMX. And they worked on the foundational stuff.
Okay.
And while the sort of the day-to-day scripts and like artists, the glue between the different applications were done by the different
software
teams. Shows.
Show teams.
Yeah. At Method, we do have TDs who are on shows and who are writing good code, but then mm-hmm. there was also more of a central software team,
and that's what you're heading.
Yes, but it's the software team, but we're doing the core software and the pipeline development.
Are you coding?
I at the beginning I was trying to code a lot, but trying to do the coding and still keep on top of what everybody else is working on ended up being sort of difficult. And then
so you're managing more now.
I'm managing more now.
Wow, you're a suit.
Chris.
No. It's all good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still. It's been pretty fun. It's been pretty educational. I love the team, and I feel like Method in the last 5 years has really been trying to make the transition from the small commercial house to the big feature company. And right now,
I started at Method when it was like literally like a small commercial place, like run, you know, so lean.
Yes.
Yeah. Before it even merged with Riot. So it was like really, it was not at all even close to what you, I mean, I walked into the building a few weeks ago and I was visiting you guys and I was like,
it's great, right?
Yeah. It's nice. Yeah. It's super nice, you know? And then part of me is like realized, you know, like, oh, you know, still have the massive client services areas and all the big suites and all the big Flame guys are there. I saw Klaus and he's like, he is, in my mind, one of the best Flame artists in this city. I'm saying that because I mean it, and I've worked with him, and I've seen the magic he's done. And I'm saying this also because my wife is a Flame artist, and she's very good as well, but I think Klaus is incredible. And Method has incredible talent, and they bring in amazing work. And I guess there's all the colorists there too.
Yeah, because we're cohabitating with Company 3.
Right. So it's a place to... Yeah, there's some. You probably see your fair share of big directors and celebrities walking around.
We get celebrities walking around
a lot.
It would be unprofessional of me to talk about those.
No, you're not. But I'm not going to ask you to. But basically, if you have a lot of films get finished there, so if you're going to see something correctly, you're going to go to Method to see it done correctly. And Company 3 is obviously one of the leading colorists in this in this city, if not in the entire industry. So you've got a lot of people that are going to come in there and see stuff. So you got to support those clients.
Yeah, but you, in terms of the tool set, it's a different set of tools you need to do small commercials versus the big features. And plus,
Yeah.
We've just recently really started trying to work more closely across sites. So we have an LA office. We have a Vancouver office.
So yeah, how many offices do you guys have?
So we have, you know, we have three big ones. So there's some offices that are doing more just the hourly work, you know, the flame finishing stuff.
Sure.
But so the ones that are doing, the primary visual effects offices are New York, Vancouver, and LA. We had a London office that was absorbed into another deluxe entity.
Okay. So let's just put this in perspective. Let's put the Method umbrella in. Method is obviously a brand that works really well. And that's why it was absorbed. And several companies adopted the Method brand, even though other companies have come in. And so that has sort of formed that entity. But overall, Method is owned by Deluxe.
Right, yes.
Right? In the same way that, MPC is owned by Technicolor?
Yep.
Okay. So Technicolor actually owns MPC and everything else. And there was actually a chart I saw recently that Technicolor is... and all of its sub-brands is by far the largest visual effects or post company in the world.
Well, doesn't MPC have 2,500 people?
Yeah, and then you add all the Technicolor stuff on top of that. It's insanely large, right? So Deluxe is a competitor to Technicolor directly,
right?
And so they own the MPC brand. So Method as a brand is equivalent in a sense that the way that Technicolor owns MPC. You could almost think of it that way.
I think so. But Deluxe owns, like there's this
they
whole-
own a lot.
There's this whole creative services division where you can go from, like Deluxe owns Stereo D, they own Beast, they own-
Encore.
Yeah, Encore, Rushes. Like they're all like tons and tons of companies.
Yeah, lots of companies. Yeah, so it's actually really hard to say because you guys share all those resources. That's what I'm trying to get at is that you guys, like Method as a brand is tied into a lot of other brands because of the Deluxe umbrella, right?
Yeah.
So you must spend a lot of time figuring out how to connect all those webs, right?
It's yes.
And make, I mean, it's a, I mean, I'm not trying to say anything else. I mean, like, that's a big thing, right?
Yeah.
Like trying to figure out how to get all those offices to work together and how to everyone to agree on things. Those are tough, right?
And I think for certain brands, it doesn't really even make sense to share. But like, so within Method, we're making sure that we're all totally on the same page and sharing everything we can. But
right.
I mean, there are other divisions of Deluxe where it doesn't really make
no,
sense.
No. If there's a bunch of guys at Encore that are working on whatever TV show and they've got their system working, it's not going to be the same thing that it's going to take to get something else done, right? Absolutely not. They're going to use their own tools. They're going to get it done the way they need to get done.
But we're definitely looking for more places we can leverage each other's technology. And
there were
probably points years ago where we weren't talking as much, but now we are having more conversations across the different business divisions to make sure we can collaborate.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. What kind of tools do you like working on? Like what's some of the things that you find interesting right now?
I mean, stuff that I find interesting is probably the same stuff that you find interesting.
Really? What's that?
I think you brought up the cloud earlier.
Yeah.
I do think that that's an interesting...
I think it's a huge thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of companies are already doing that successfully. And it's one of those things that definitely will become a cornerstone for a lot of companies in the future.
Yeah. I mean, the minute I hear people say and I talk about cloud and they're like, well, that'll never happen in my company because of the MPA. I was like, well, have you talked to the MPA recently? Because they're allowing a lot more cloud.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think cloud is important, and I think that's a really fascinating thing. To be honest.
And it's like from certain perspectives, it's so simple. I mean, it ends up just being a set of VMs that you can spin up or spin down in the cloud, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really just surging your interfarm. But then the like licensing becomes this entirely different thing because sure, Google might charge you like 10 minutes or something for a node, but can you really get your render queue licenses by the minute? Or by every 10 minutes.
All those people are trying to adapt to that too, right?
Everyone at the same time is trying to adapt to this new technology. Yep. And that, to me, is interesting. And then also trying to figure out, when you're looking into the cloud, I mean, you can try to directly mount back to your storage. And then that way, you don't end up having to run like a sync process to their file system. And then, I don't know, like some of the render providers have a partnership with Avair, where Avair does the local caching.
Yep.
So they they can potentially, you can connect to someplace through the Aver and then it'll cache things locally. So you don't have to, you can really just treat. It was the same way actually DD had this set up in Vegas, right? Yeah. Where their Vegas nodes were all behind an Aver. So you didn't really have to worry about the latency. You could still just mount directly back to the DD storage in Venice. Yeah. And then the first time something was read, it would be cached.
Well, there's other ways of doing it. I mean, it's interesting if you listen to just even the way that some of the guys over Atomic Fiction are doing things. And what's interesting about those guys is
the conductor, right?
They're using Conductor, which is their own system. Yeah. I guess they were using something before, but they wrote their own. The people they're hiring to work on Conductor are people they would never have hired before. They're people that work on like eBay, right? They work people that work on systems that are internet based for large internet infrastructure stuff, right? Yep. So those guys know how to cache data and how to store stuff in different locations, right? And just, you know, for people that are wondering, like YouTube does the same thing if you're Google, right? You type in a YouTube, it just randomly starts up on your computer, but Google is actually really smart about caching that video depending on your location.
Oh, interesting.
So like if you're looking at a video that only one area is interested in doing, it's not actually going to cache it in other locations. Huh. So if like it doesn't just automatically put the YouTube everywhere on Google around the world. It caches it based on anticipating where the load is going to be. So they actually have systems to deal with that. So and the same thing happens on big web structures, right? Like eBay or those guys or Amazon Music or Spotify, whatever. They already know it's like this music is going to be popular here. It's going to need make sure this is cached here. This music is going to be cached there. So they cache their systems in different locations based on that. So the people who write that kind of software understand how to cache data and how to do stuff is the same deal. And it's like, this shot's being worked on actively, so we need to make sure it's cached here. Mm-hmm. So all of that idea of how the internet works is going to become important in terms of how we work. If we're going to start using the internet as a render farm, that's going to be the key. It was really, I'm learning a lot. As someone who doesn't even code or anything else, but just sort of learning a lot about how people are dealing with this data, because we're talking about a lot of data that we're trying to get back and forth, but yet somehow people are making it work even with a single gigabit internet port, right? Mm-hmm. They're keeping the data on the cloud as long as possible, right? And there's other costs as well that we talk about. Boris, I did a podcast with Boris. Yeah, I know you haven't caught up yet, but Boris is our main V-Ray cloud guy. And he talks about there's cost to ingestion versus...
Yeah, don't get charged to put things on there only when you get them back.
Only when you get them back. So you keep them on there as long as possible until they're ready to bring back.
Yeah.
And so you only bring back small bits as you're seeing them, and then you bring the final stuff back when it's done.
Yep.
So all of that is interesting cost-wise to think about where the cloud is going. And I think people are going to learn that system, or better yet, people are going to build that system for you and you will just use that system and license it. Mm. But yeah, we're all trying to figure out the licensing thing.
Yeah.
And I think a term that people are going to start to use a lot more, and it's already happening now, is software as a service.
So
software is not going to be like buying a license of your software or buying a render node version of your software, that's going away. I truly believe that you're not going to say, like, how many render nodes do I need of V-Ray, or how many render nodes do I need of Arnold, and how much is that going to cost me? It doesn't even matter. You're never going to render on a render node anymore. You're going to render on the cloud, and you're going to pay as you go.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, for to bill a production directly, it's the best thing ever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now is a good question, right? Because now your cost of your software is based on the amount of time you use it.
Mm-hmm.
So now what's the cost of your license in terms of rendering? How fast it is. The faster your renderer, the cheaper your renderer is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're adamant about a biased render and you don't care how long the render time is, that render now becomes dollar for dollar more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be cheaper to have a render that's faster. So you're faster the renderer, which is, let's say, a biased system that uses a cache system for, you know, or Global Illumination, let's just say something like the software we have, is actually significantly cheaper than something that's going to be completely unbiased. So that's going to become the difference.
What's your experience been with GPUs in the cloud?
Okay, that's an excellent question. GPUs in a cloud are rarer. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of cloud rendering or cloud computing is fairly new. I don't think people really thought of it until much recently. I mean, it's been used for a while, mostly for like Netflix and stuff like that. But in terms of actual hardcore compute, it's not being used, especially in our world. It's fairly new. GPU is going to be significantly cheaper, but in terms of time, mm-hmm. But is it going to, how much is it going to cost to get? It's harder to find, right? You can get some GPUs on Amazon. I think you can get some on Google. I'm not sure. Azure, you can get some, but they're going to be rare. I can spin up 10,000 computers on Google in a second. Mm-hmm. But with GPUs, it's going to be a little bit harder. So I don't know. GPUs are definitely going to make a difference.
Yeah. And then we haven't talked about VR the whole podcast.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, I've talked a lot about VR. Are you doing VR stuff?
Deluxe actually started a new division called Deluxe VR.
Okay. So LinkedIn post today with Juan Gomez.
Yeah. So Juan Gomez, Peter Shipkov.
Oh, Peter Shipkov. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's that division all about?
VR.
Okay. And what are they doing in VR? Because a lot of people can just say VR in front of their title and they don't know what they're doing.
I think they had a demo at NAB. I haven't actually seen the latest stuff.
Is it content creation?
You'd probably have to read the press release.
Maybe I should have Juan on this podcast.
Yeah, Juan or Peter.
Yeah. Or to both of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are they in LA still?
Yeah, they're working in Santa Monica. It's a different deluxe office. It's at where Beast used to be. It's like 6th at
Then yes, Arizona, I will definitely like Juan Gomez, who I love. I work with him on Tron.
Yeah.
And Maleficent and a bunch of stuff as well. Yeah. Yeah, he's awesome, awesome guy.
He is fantastic. Yep.
The Colombian light god. Yeah, he's a fantastic guy. Interesting. So were you involved in any of that or?
Not really, no. I mean, I was working.
Was Method doing any VR work?
The people who started working on it were originally part of Method. They didn't actually formalize that company until pretty recently.
Mm.
But yeah, so it originated from Method, but for new technology, sometimes it just makes more sense to do it in a separate group.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. There's been obviously a lot of companies that have started their own VR branches. Framestore has done it, and I think MPC may have done it as well. I may mm-hmm. be wrong on that. So, but that all makes sense. Yeah. Obviously, DD has been involved in a bunch of VR work as well.
Yeah.
So it's cool. It's really cool. All right. We're actually kind of
over
a little over our time. How are you feeling? How did you like doing the podcast?
It's fun. It's a little weird.
What's weird about it?
Well, I don't know. I feel like first of all, I'm probably never going to listen to this because.
Yeah. I've had people say that.
Too. Yeah. But yeah, it'll be, I'm curious if I said anything stupid that I'll be hearing about.
You didn't say anything stupid. You talked about porn time for a little
bit. That's true, yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. That's good. People should know that there was a period in time. There was a big period in time in the visual effects industry where porn was massively distributed to people's computers. And that is a fact. That's a historic fact.
Yeah. I've heard it doesn't happen anymore, though.
No.
But it was amazing how much time.
It was so prominent, though. People, it was like, and it was not good. You were trying to outshock each other.
People would spend so much time in Photoshop putting other people's faces like into the scenes.
Yes. Yes. I remember, I'm actually going to name names on this one because I think it's worth it. I believe that Rob Niederhorst was pranking Mark Rienzo and left about 100 windows open on his computer of horrific porn that was on his computer. And then when he unlocked his screen and he showed up, there was just at that moment, there was a studio tour going by at Digital Main and he was trying to close all the windows and he was like frantic, like hitting Alt F4 or whatever he could do to close all the windows that was going on. Yeah. Yeah. Happens a lot. Happened a lot. That I haven't seen that kind of behavior in a while.
So where's the best place you've ever worked?
Best place I've ever worked?
Yeah. Aside from now, like now you can't, like, but from a visual effects.
I'm actually going to say, like, and I'm saying this very legitimately, now is amazing to me because of the amount of creative freedom I have, which was a surprise to me. I did not, people would think, you know, oh, you're going to go work for a software company. You know, yeah. I remember listening to those guys, and I don't want to, you know, say, but, you know, oh, this guy's going to end up working at Autodesk or whatever, that's going out to pasture, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you're not working on the movies anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And, that's fine, and I get it. And you know, you have your family to support, and you want a stable job. All of that is true. And by the way, which I did when I came to this company, I was like, I wanted a stable job. I wanted to stay creative. I did not expect it to be as creative as it is now. I did not expect to be able to do as many interesting things that I actually decided to do. Most of the time I worked on was other projects, but. Your question is, besides now, what was the best place I worked? There's two places that stand out to me. Digital Domain was a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a lot of it is because that's where it started for me. That's a lot of where the visual effects started, and that's where I learned a lot of stuff. It's also working at that place is very tiring.
Yeah.
It's very tiring, and you know, it's a very young attitude towards there, and a lot of partying in a certain sense where when you get to be our age, it tires you out, you know, and you're like, I can't do this. And it's hard not to be excited by it because you go there and you get excited like everyone else, but it's going to tire you out in a lot of ways, and you just can't deal with that. I'd highly recommend people. I mean, I don't know if it's Digital Domain, if it's the same as it used to be when you and I were there, but it was a great experience. I wouldn't change it, but I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. At this point, I'm too tired for that, you know?
Yeah.
So there's, and not to say that like, hey, it's going to be kind of bland since then, because it's not, it's just going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Sway was a really interesting company that I worked at.
Oh, interesting.
Really small. They were just around the corner from us. They're no longer around. It's a company that closed. But what I liked about Sway, Mark Glazer and those guys, that sort of gave me the ability to sort of take control of a lot of the company because it was small in terms of what the 3D team was doing. And Mark trusted me to form that team. And I formed some very, very strong bonds. And I learned a lot in terms of leadership skills and in terms of making getting the best out of people. We did some awesome work, awesome work at Sway. It was mostly car commercials, but they looked fantastic. And I learned a lot about it at Sway. So I'd say those two were really cool. When I went to Method, it was great. Like I said, it was a lot like Sway. It was a small commercial place. There was some turmoil that happened during the mergers, and it grew. And it wasn't necessarily the right place for me. And I was sort of struggling a little bit dealing with some of the leaderships that was going on over there. So when DD came to me and they said, we want to do Tron, it was like, I can't pass that on.
Yeah.
So I took that thing. Not to say that you know the talent at the Method is still very, very strong, and it's great. Obviously, Method is thriving.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably one of the leading visual effects company in Los Angeles now, which is so interesting, coming from being in that small building in Santa Monica and now like they're the leading visual effects company in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So really, really kind of interesting. So I love, Method's great. Method's really cool. And I'm proud that they've gotten this far, man. It's really cool. Stefan should be proud.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still the overall creative guy for the company, right?
Yep. The chief creative officer, I think.
Chief creative officer.
For all of the creative services brands for Deluxe.
Gotcha. Yeah. Awesome. Well, good for him, man. He did a good job. And he's earned that reputation and deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
So good for him. Well, cool. What's the best place you've ever worked at?
Well,
I'll throw that out to
it's
you.
It's funny. Yeah. And it's funny, you kind of have to put a time period on the place, too.
Exactly. It's kind of like Madidi was great at that time.
Yes. And it's funny, like...
You mentioned Weta.
I joked earlier today to somebody that the best place to work was ESC in
2004. Were you at ESC?
No. But you hear, when you hear people talk about it, they talk about it like it was this, like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was like Atlantis. It was like, oh, my God. It was just amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. For me, just in terms of production, and I'm like... in terms of being in production, Real Steel was just fantastic.
Here's the one thing I'm going to say about the Real Steel thing, and I know it's kind of a backhanded insult, meaning it's actually a good thing. It was so smooth that it became actually like boring. There was no problems to solve.
Yeah.
And I remember going to you at some point because I was, I was coming off of Tron, and they were sort of putting me on Real Steel to just fill a gap until the next show would happen. So I was very happy to just like sit around and just light a few things and do some look dev, et cetera, et cetera.
You added Fresnel to every material on the show. You just like went through and looked at it.
Well, it's like looked at. I was like, what the hell are you doing? And like tore off every shader and like added Fresnel. And they looked a little bit, in my mind, it looked a little bit better. Yeah. But I remember it was like, I lit all the shots and I was like, okay, Blake, I need more shots. And you're like, I don't have any more. It's like... but I'm out of shots and I've got 3 more weeks on the show. And that's why it was like, it was so smooth that I could just light it like, 2-3 shots a day. And they barely got any reviews. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it. I liked Real Steel. I liked it a lot. It'd be fun to revisit that. I wonder is Laura Lee over at?
She's Disney.
She's at Disney.
Yep.
I should see what she's doing. She's funny. She's an interesting person.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Yep. And Nat's over there too.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Yep. All right. All right, cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. Is there anything else you want to announce?
No. Nothing to announce.
Nothing to announce?
No.
So what's your title?
Head of Software at Method Studios.
Head of Software at Method Studios. That does sound like Doug Robel.
Yeah, I guess it does. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Well, let me know what's going on and when we're going to start lining up for your new SciTech Awards.
My God. Yeah. At some point.
It'll be all about cloud rendering.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, make some amazing cloud rendering stuff that's going to get you a SciTech Award. That would be a goal for you. There you go. All right, Blake. All right. Thanks. I appreciate it. We're going to let the last bucket drop. All right, guys.
Where's
thank
the
you.
Bucket?
Yeah. What the, oh, it's added in post, I hate to tell you.